he'd risked his skin to avoid the bedding ritual, hoping to preserve the privacy of his bedchamber, but that hope had been dashed quick enough. Either Sansa had been stupid enough to confide in one of her bedmaids, every one of whom was a spy for Cersei, or Varys and his little birds were to blame. What difference did it make? They were laughing at him all the same. The only person in the Red Keep who didn't seem to find his marriage a source of amusement was his lady wife. Sansa's misery was deepening every day. Tyrion would gladly have broken through her courtesy to give her what solace he might, but it was no good. No words would ever make him fair in her eyes. Or any less a Lannister. This was the wife they had given him for all the rest of his life, and she hated him. And their nights together in the great bed were another source of torment. He could no longer bear to sleep naked, as had been his custom. His wife was too well trained ever to say an unkind word, but the revulsion in her eyes, whenever she looked on his body, was more than he could bear. Tyrion had commanded Sansa to wear a sleeping shift as well. "I want her," he realized. "I want Winterfell, yes, but I want her as well, child or woman or whatever she is. I want to comfort her. I want to hear her laugh. I want her to come to me willingly, to bring me her joys and her sorrows and her lust." His mouth twisted in a bitter smile. "Yes, and I want to be tall as Jaime and as strong as Sir Gregor the Mountain, too, for all the bloody good it does." Unbidden, his thoughts went to Shay. Tyrion had not wanted her to hear the news from any lips but his own, so he had commanded Varys to bring her to him the night before his wedding. They met again in the eunuch's chambers, and when Shay began to undo the laces of his jerkin, he caught her by the wrist and pushed it away. "Wait," he said. "There is something you must hear. On the morrow I am to be wed to Sansa Stark, or no?" He was speechless for an instant. Even Sansa did not know, not then. "How could you know? Did Varys tell you?" "Some page was telling Sir Tallard about it when I took Lollies to the Sept. He had it from this serving girl who'd heard Sir Kevin talking to your father." She wriggled free of his grasp and pulled her dress up over her head. As ever, she was naked underneath.
"I don't care. She's only a little girl. You'll give her a big belly and come back to me."
Some part of him had hoped for less indifference.
"Had hoped," he jeered bitterly.
"But now you know better, dwarf. Shay is all the love you're ever like to have."
Muddy Way was crowded, but soldiers and townfolk alike made way for the imp and his escort. Hollow-eyed children swarmed underfoot, some looking up in silent appeal, while others begged noisily. Tyrion pulled a big fistful of coppers from his purse and tossed them in the air, and the children went running for them, shoving and shouting. The lucky ones might be able to buy a heel of stale bread tonight. He had never seen markets so crowded. And for all the food the Tyrells were bringing in, prices remained shockingly high. 6 coppers for a melon, 1 silver stag for a bushel of corn, 1 dragon for a side of beef, or 6 skinny piglets. Yet there seemed no lack of buyers. Gaunt men and haggard women crowded around every wagon and stall, whilst others even more ragged looked on sullenly from the mouths of alleys.
"This way!" Bronn said, as they reached the foot of the hook. "If you still mean to—"
"I do." The riverfront had made a convenient excuse, but Tyrion had another purpose today. It was not a task he relished, but it must be done. They turned away from Aegon's high hill into the maze of smaller streets that clustered around the foot of Visenya's. Bronn led the way. Once or twice, Tyrion glanced back over his shoulder to see if they were being followed, but there was nothing to be seen except the usual rabble. A carter beating his horse, an old woman throwing night soil from her window, 2 little boys fighting with sticks, 3 gold cloaks escorting a captive. They all looked innocent, but any one of them could be his undoing. Varys had informers everywhere. They turned at a corner, and again at the next, and rode slowly through a crowd of women at a well. Bronn led him along a curving wind through an alley under a broken archway. They cut through the rubble where a house had burned and walked their horses up a shallow flight of stone steps. The buildings were close and poor. Bronn halted at the mouth of a crooked alley too narrow for two to ride abreast. "There's two jags and then a dead end. The sink is in the cellar of the last building." Tyrion swung down off his horse. "See that no one enters or leaves till I return. This won't take long." His hand went into his cloak to make certain the gold was still there in the hidden pocket. 30 dragons. A bloody fortune for a man like him. He waddled up the alley quickly, anxious to be done with this. The wine sink was a dismal place, dark and damp, walls pale with nitre, the ceiling so low that Bronn would have to duck to keep from hitting his head on the beams. Tyrion Lannister had no such problem. At this hour the front room was empty, but for a dead-eyed woman who sat on a stool behind a rough plank bar. She handed him a cup of sour wine and said, "In the back." The back room was even darker. A flickering candle burned on a low table beside a flagon of wine. The man behind it scarce looked in danger, a short man, though all men were tall to Tyrion, with thinning brown hair, pink cheeks, and a little pot pushing at the bone buttons of his doeskin jerkin. In his soft hands he held a 12-stringed woodharp, more deadly than a longsword. Tyrion sat across from him. "Simon Silvertongue?" The man inclined his head. He was bald on top.
"My lord and," he said, "you mistake me. My father is the king's and. I am no longer even a finger, I fear." "You shall rise again, I am sure, a man like you. My sweet lady Shade tells me you are newly wed. Would that you had sent for me earlier. I should have been honoured to sing at your feast."
"The last thing my wife needs is more songs," said Tyrion. "As for Shay, we both know she is no lady, and I would thank you never to speak her name aloud."
"As the hand commands,"
Simon said. The last time Tyrion had seen the man, a sharp word had been enough to set him sweating, but it seemed the singer had found some courage somewhere, most like in that flagon. Or perhaps Tyrion himself was to blame for this new boldness.
"I threatened him, but nothing ever came of the threat, so now he believes me toothless."
He sighed. "I am told you are a very gifted singer."
"You're most kind to say so, my lord."
Tyrion gave him a smile.
"I think it is time you brought your music to the Free Cities. They are great lovers of song in Braavos and Pentos and Lys, and generous with those who please them."
He took a sip of wine. It was foul stuff, but strong.
"A tour of all 9 cities would be best. You wouldn't want to deny anyone the joy of hearing you sing. A year in each would suffice."
He reached inside his cloak to where the gold was hidden.
"With the port closed, you will need to go to Duskendale to take ship. But my man Bronn would find a horse for you, and I would be honoured if you would let me pay your passage."
"But my lord," the man objected, "you've never heard me sing. Pray, listen a moment."
His fingers moved deftly over the strings of the woodharp, and soft music filled the cellar. Simon began to sing.
"He rode through the streets of the city, down from his hill on high. O'er the wines and the steps and the cobbles, he rode to a woman's side. For she was his secret treasure, she was his shame and his bliss, and a chain and a keeper, nothing compared to a woman's kiss."
"There's more," the man said as he broke off. "Oh, a good deal more. The refrain is especially nice, I think.
For hands of gold are always cold, but a woman's hands are warm.
Enough! Tyrion slid his fingers from his cloak empty. That's not a song I would care to hear again. Ever.
No.
Simon Silvertongue put his harp aside and took a sip of wine.
A pity. Still, each man has his song, as me old master used to say when he was teaching me to play. Others might like my tune better. The Queen, perhaps, or your Lord Father.
Tyrion rubbed the scar over his nose and said, "My father has no time for singers, and my sister is not as generous as one might think. A wise man could earn more from silence than from song." He could not put it much plainer than that. Simon seemed to take his meaning quick enough.
"You will find my price modest, my lord."
"That's good to know." This would not be a matter of 30 golden dragons, Tyrion feared.
"Tell me. At King Joffrey's wedding feast," the man said, "there is to be a tournament of singers."
"And jugglers, and jesters, and dancing bears."
"Only one dancing bear, my lord,"
said Simon, who had plainly attended Cersei's arrangements with far more interest than Tyrion had.
"But 7 singers, Galleon of Kai, Bethany Fairfingers, Aemon Costain, Alric of Ison, Hamish the Harper, Collio Canis, and Orlan of Oldtown will compete for a gilded lute with silver strings. Yet unaccountably, no invitation has been forthcoming for one who is master of them all."
"Let me guess. Simon Silvertongue." Simon smiled modestly.
"I'm prepared to prove the truth of my boast before king and court. Hamish is old and oft forgets what he's singing. And Collio, with that absurd Tyroshi accent. If you understand one word in 3, count yourself fortunate."
"My sweet sister has arranged the feast. Even if I could secure you this invitation, it might look queer. 7 kingdoms, 7 vows, 7 challenges, 77 dishes, but 8 singers? What would the High Septon think?"
"You did not strike me as a pious man, my lord."
"Piety is not the point. Certain forms must be observed." Simon took a sip of wine.
"Still, a singer's life is not without peril. We ply our trade in alehouses and wine sinks before unruly drunkards. If one of your sister's 7 should suffer some mishap, I hope you might consider me to fill his place."
He smiled slyly, inordinately pleased with himself. 6 singers would be as unfortunate as 8, to be sure. I will inquire after the health of Cersei's 7. If any of them should be indisposed, my man Bronn will find you."
"Very good, my lord."
Simon might have left it at that, but flushed with triumph he added,
"I shall sing the night of King Joffrey's wedding. Should it happen that I am called to court, why, I will want to offer the king my very best compositions, songs I have sung 1,000 times that are certain to please. If I should find myself singing in some dreary wine sink, though, well, that would be an apt occasion to try my new song. For the hands of gold are always cold, but a woman's hands are warm."
"That will not be necessary," said Tyrion. "You have my word as a Lannister. Bronn will call upon you soon."
"Very good, my lord."
The balding, kettle-bellied singer took up his wood harp again. Bronn was waiting with the horses at the mouth of the alley. He helped Tyrion into his saddle.
"When do I take the man to Duskendale?"
"You don't," Tyrion turned his horse. "Give him 3 days, then inform him that Hamish the Harper has broken his arm. Tell him that his clothes will never serve for court, so he must be fitted for new garb at once. He'll come with you quick enough." He grimaced. "You may want his tongue. I understand it's made of silver. The rest of him should never be found." Bronn grinned.
There's a pot shop I know in Flea Bottom makes a savoury bowl of brown. All kinds of meat in it, I hear.
Make certain I never eat there. Tyrion spurred to a trot. He wanted a bath, and the hotter the better. Even that modest pleasure was denied him, however. No sooner had he returned to his chambers than Podrick Payne informed him that he had been summoned to the Tower of the Hand.
"His lordship wants to see you. The Hand, Lord Tarwin."
"I recall who the Hand is, Pod," Tyrion said. "I lost my nose, not my wits."
Bronn laughed. "Don't bite the boy's head off now."
"Why not? He never uses it." Tyrion wondered what he'd done now.
"Or more like, what I have failed to do."
A summons from Lord Tywin always had teeth. His father never sent for him just to share a meal or a cup of wine, that was for certain. As he entered his lord father, Sola, a few moments later, he heard a voice saying,
"Cherry wood for the scabbards, bound in red leather and ornamented with a row of lion's head studs in pure gold, perhaps with garnets for the eyes."
"Rubies," Lord Tywin said. "A garnet, lack the fire."
Tyrion cleared his throat. "My lord, you sent for me?" His father glanced up.
"I did. Come, have a look at this."
A bundle of oilcloth lay on the table between them, and Lord Tywin had a longsword in his hand.
"A wedding gift for Joffrey," he told Tyrion.
The light, shimmering through the diamond-shaped panes of glass, made the blade shimmer black and red, as Lord Tywin turned it to inspect the edge, while the pommel and crossguard flamed gold.
"With this fool's jabber of Stannis in his magic sword, it seemed to me that we had best give Joffrey something extraordinary as well. A king should bear a kingly weapon."
"That's much too much sword for Joff," Tyrion said.
"He will grow into it. Here, feel the weight of it."
He offered the weapon hilt first. The sword was much lighter than he had expected. As he turned it in his hand, he saw why. Only one metal could be beaten so thin and still have strength enough to fight with, and there was no mistaking those ripples, the mark of steel that has been folded back on itself many thousands of times.
"Valyrian steel?"
"Yes," Lord Tywin said, in a tone of deep satisfaction.
"At long last, father." Valyrian steel blades were scarce and costly, yet thousands remained in the world, perhaps 200 in the Seven Kingdoms alone. It had always irked his father that none belonged to House Lannister. The old kings of the Rock had owned such a weapon, but the great sword Brightroar had been lost when the Second King Tommen carried it back to Valyria on his fool's quest. He had never returned, nor had Uncle Gerry, the youngest and most reckless of his father's brothers, who had gone seeking after the lost sword some 8 years past. Thrice at least Lord Tywin had offered to buy Valyrian longswords from impoverished lesser houses, but his advances had always been firmly rebuffed. The little lordlings would gladly part with their daughters, should a Lannister come asking, but they cherished their old family swords. Tyrion wondered where the metal for this one had come from. A few master armourers could rework old Valyrian steel, but the secrets of its making had been lost when the doom came to old Valyria.
"The colours are strange,"
he commented as he turned the blade in the sunlight. Most Valyrian steel was of grey so dark it looked almost black, as was true here as well. But blended into the folds was a red as deep as the grey. The two colours lapped over one another without ever touching, each ripple distinct, like waves of night and blood upon some steely shore.
"How did you get this patterning? I've never seen anything like it."
"Nor I, my lord," said the armourer. "I confess these colours were not what I intended, and I do not know that I could duplicate them. Your lord father had asked for the crimson of your house, and it was that colour I set out to infuse into the metal. But Valyrian steel is stubborn, eh? These old swords remember, it is said, and they do not change easily. I worked 50 spells and brightened the red time and time again, but always the colour would darken as if the blade was drinking the sun from it. And some foals would not take the red at all, as you can see. If my lords of Lannister are displeased, I will, of course, try again, as many times as you should require, but...
No need, Lord Tywin said. This will serve.
A crimson sword might flash prettily in the sun, but if truth be told, I like these colours better, said Tyrion. They have an ominous beauty, and they make this blade unique. There is no other sword like it in all the world, I should think.
There is one. The armourer bent over the table and unfolded the bundle of oilcloth to reveal a second longsword. Tyrion put down Joffrey's sword and took up the other. If not twins, the two were at least close cousins. This one was thicker and heavier, a half inch wider and 3 inches longer, but they shared the same fine clean lines and the same distinctive colour, the ripples of blood and night. Three fullers, deeply incised, ran down the second blade from hilt to point. The king's sword had only two. Joff's hilt was a good deal more ornate, the arms of its cross-guard done with lion's paws, with ruby claws unsheathed, but both swords had grips of finely tooled red leather and gold lion's heads for pummels. Magnificent! Even in hands as unskilled as Tyrion's, the blade felt alive. I have never felt better balance.
It is meant for my son.
No need to ask which son.
Tyrion placed Jaime's sword back on the table beside Joffrey's, wondering if Robb Stark would let his brother live long enough to wield it.
Our father must surely think so, else why have this blade forged?
You have done good work, Master Mutt, Lord Tywin told the armourer. My steward will see to your payment, and remember, rubies for the scabbards.
I shall, my lord, you are most generous.
The man folded the swords up in the oilcloth, tucked the bundle under one arm, and went to his knee.
It is an honour to serve the king's hand. I shall deliver the swords the day before the wedding.
I see that you do.
When the guards had seen the armour out, Tyrion clambered up into a chair. So, a sword for Joff, a sword for Jaime, and not even a dagger for the dwarf. Is that the way of it, father?
The steel was sufficient for two blades, not three. If you have need of a dagger, take one from the armory. Robert left 100 when he died. Geryon gave him a gilded dagger with an ivory grip and a sapphire pommel for a wedding gift. And half the envoys who came to court tried to curry favour by presenting his grace with jewel-encrusted knives and silver-inlay swords.
Tyrion smiled. They'd have pleased him more if they'd presented him with their daughters.
No doubt. The only blade he ever used was a hunting knife he had from John Aaron when he was a boy.
Lord Tywin waved a hand, dismissing King Robert and all his knives.
What did you find at the riverfront?
Mud, said Tyrion, and a few dead things no one bothered to bury. Before we can open the port again, the Blackwater is going to have to be dredged, the sunken ships broken up or raised. 3/4 of the quays need repair, and some may have to be torn down and rebuilt. The entire fish market is gone, and both the River Gate and the King's Gate are splintered from the battering Stannis gave them, and should be replaced. I shudder to think of the cost. If you do shit gold, father, find a privy and get busy.
He wanted to say, but he knew better.
You will find whatever gold is required.
Will I? Where?
The treasury is empty. I've told you that.
We've not done paying the alchemists for that wildfire, or the smiths for my chain.
and Cersei's pledged the crown to pay half the cost of Joffrey's wedding. 77 bloody courses, 1,000 guests, a pie full of doves, singers, jugglers.
Extravagance has its uses. We must demonstrate the power and wealth of Casterly Rock for all the realm to see.
Then perhaps Casterly Rock should pay.
Why? I have seen Littlefinger's accounts. Crown incomes are 10 times higher than they were under Aerys.
As are the crown's expenses. Robert was as generous with his coin as he was with his cock. Littlefinger borrowed heavily. From you, amongst others? Yes, the incomes are considerable, but they are barely sufficient to cover the usury on Littlefinger's loans. Will you forgive the throne's debt to House Lannister?
Don't be absurd.
Then perhaps 7 courses would suffice. 300 guests instead of 1,000. I understand that a marriage can be just as binding without a dancing bear.
The Tyrells would think us niggardly. I will have the wedding and the waterfront. If you cannot pay for them, say so. And I shall find a master of coin who can.
The disgrace of being dismissed after so short a time was not something Tyrion cared to suffer.
I will find your money.
You will, his father promised. And while you are about it, see if you can find your wife's bed as well.
So the talk has reached even him. I have, thank you. It's that piece of furniture between the window and the hearth, with the velvet canopy and the mattress stuffed with goose down.
I'm pleased you know of it. Now perhaps you ought to try and know the woman who shares it with you.
Woman? Child, you mean? Has a spider been whispering in your ear, or do I have my sweet sister to thank?
Considering the things that went on beneath Cersei's blankets, you would think she'd have the decency to keep her nose out of his.
Tell me, why is it that all of Sansa's maids are women in Cersei's service? I am sick of being spied upon in my own chambers.
If you mislike your wife's servants, dismiss them and hire ones more to your liking. That is your right. It is your wife's maidenhood that concerns me, not her maids. This, delicacy puzzles me. You seem to have no difficulty bedding whores. Is this Stark girl made differently?
Why would you take so much bloody interest in where I put my cock?
Tyrion demanded.
Sansa is too young.
She is old enough to be Lady of Winterfell once her brother is dead. Claim her maidenhood, and you will be one step closer to claiming the North. Get her with child, and the prize is all but won. Do I need to remind you that a marriage that has not been consummated can be set aside?
By the High Septon, or a Council of Faith? Our present High Septon is a trained seal who barks prettily on command. Moonboy is more like to annul my marriage than he is.
Perhaps I should have married Sansa Stark to Moonboy. He might have known what to do with her.
Tyrion's hands clenched on the arms of his chair.
I have heard all I mean to hear on the subject of my wife's maidenhead. But so long as we are discussing marriage, why is it that I hear nothing of my sister's impending nuptials? As I recall,
Lord Tywin cut him off.
Mace Tyrell has refused my offer to marry Cersei to his heir, Willis.
Refused, our sweet Cersei.
That put Tyrion in a much better mood.
When I first broached the match to him, Lord Tyrell seemed well enough disposed, his father said. A day later, all that was changed. The old woman's work. She hectors her son unmercifully. Varys claims she told him that your sister was too old and too used for this precious one-legged grandson of hers.
Cersei must have loved that, he laughed.
Lord Tywin gave him a chilly look.
She does not know. nor will she. It is better for all of us if the offer was never made. See that you remember that, Tyrion. The offer was never made.
What offer?
Tyrion rather suspected that Lord Tyrell might come to regret this rebuff.
Your sister will be wed. The question is, to whom? I have several thoughts.
Before he could get to them, there was a rap at the door, and a guardsman stuck in his head to announce Grand Maester Pycelle.
He may enter, said Lord Tywin.
Pycelle tottered in on a cane, and stopped long enough to give Tyrion a look that would curdle milk. His once magnificent white beard, which someone had unaccountably shaved off, was growing back sparse and wispy, leaving him with unsightly pink wattles to dangle beneath his neck.
"My Lord Hend," the old man said, bowing as deeply as he could without falling, "there has been another bird from Castle Black. Mayhaps we could consult privily."
"There's no need for that."
Lord Tywin waved Grand Maester Pycelle to a seat.
"Tyrion may stay."
"Oh, may I?"
He rubbed his nose and waited. Pycelle cleared his throat, which involved a deal of coughing and hawking.
"The letter is from the same Bowen Marsh who sent the last, the Castellan. He writes that Lord Mormont has sent word of wildlings moving south in vast numbers."
"The lands beyond the wall cannot support vast numbers," said Lord Tywin firmly. "This warning is not new."
"This last is, my lord. Mormont sent a bird from the haunted forest to report that he was under attack. More ravens have returned since, but none with letters. This Bowen Marsh fears Lord Mormont slain, with all his strength."
Tyrion had rather liked old Jaw Mormont, with his gruff manner and talking bird.
"Is this certain?" he asked.
"It is not," Pycelle admitted. "But none of Mormont's men have returned as yet. Marsh fears the wildlings have killed them, and that the wall itself may be attacked next."
He fumbled in his robe and found the paper.
"Here is his letter, my lord, a plea to all five kings. He wants men, as many men as we can send him."
"Five kings?" His father was annoyed. "There is one king in Westeros. Those fools in black might try and remember that, if they wish his grace to heed them. When you reply, tell him that Renly is dead, and the others are traitors and pretenders."
"No doubt they will be glad to learn it. The wall is a world apart, and news oft reaches them late."
Pycelle bobbed his head up and down.
"What shall I tell Marsh concerning the men he begs for? Shall we convene the council?"
"There is no need. The Night's Watch is a pack of thieves, killers, and base-born churls. But it occurs to me that they could prove otherwise, given proper discipline. If Mormont is indeed dead, the Black Brothers must choose a new Lord Commander."
Pycelle gave Tyrion a sly glance.
"An excellent thought, my lord. I know the very man, Janus Slint."
Tyrion liked that notion not at all. "The Black Brothers choose their own commander," he reminded them. "Lord Slint is new to the wall. I know. I sent him there. Why should they pick him over a dozen more senior men?"
"Because," his father said,
in a tone that suggested Tyrion was quite the simpleton,
"if they do not vote, as they are told, their wall will melt before it sees another man."
"Yes, that would work."
Tyrion hitched forward.
"Janus Slint is the wrong man, father. We do better with the commander of the Shadow Tower, or Eastwatch by the sea."
"The commander of the Shadow Tower is a Malister of Seaguard. Eastwatch is held by an Iron Man."
"Neither would serve his purposes," Lord Tywin's tone said, clear enough.
"Janus Slint is a butcher's son," Tyrion reminded his father forcefully. "You yourself told me."
"I recall what I told you. Castle Black is not Harren Hal, however. The Night's Watch is not the King's Council. There is a tool for every task, and a task for every tool."
Tyrion's anger flashed. "Lord Janus is a hollow suit of armor who will sell himself to the highest bidder."
"I count that a point in his favor. Who is like to bid higher than us?"
He turned to Pycelle.
"Send a raven. Write that King Joffrey was deeply saddened to hear of Lord Commander Mormont's death, but regrets that he can spare no men just now, while so many rebels and usurpers remain in the field. Suggest that matters might be quite different once the throne is secure. Provided the king has full confidence in the leadership of the watch. In closing, ask March to pass along his grace's fondest regards to his faithful friend and servant, Lord Janus Slint."
"Yes, my lord,"
Pycelle bobbed his withered head once more.
"I shall write as the hand commands, with great pleasure."
"I should have trimmed his head, not his beard," Tyrion reflected. "And Slint should have gone for a swim with his dear friend, Alar Dean. At least he had not made the same foolish mistake with Simon Silvertongue. See there, father," he wanted to shout. "See how fast I learn my lessons." Samwell. Up in the loft, a woman was giving birth noisily, while below a man lay dying by the fire. Samwell Tarly could not say which frightened him more. They covered poor Bannon with a pile of furs and stoked the fire high, yet all he could say was,
"I'm cold. Oh, please, I'm so cold."
Sam was trying to feed him onion broth, but he could not swallow. The broth dribbled over his lips and down his chin as fast as Sam could spoon it in.
"That one's dead."
Craster eyed the man with indifference as he worried at a sausage.
"Be kinder to stick a knife in his chest than that spoon down his throat," he asked me.
"I don't recall as we did." Giant was no more than 5 feet tall. His true name was Bedwick, but a fierce little man for all that. "Slayer, did you ask Craster for his counsel?" Sam cringed at the name, but shook his head. He filled another spoon, brought it to Bannon's mouth, and tried to ease it between his lips. "Food and fire," Giant was saying. "That was all we asked of you. And you grudge us the food?"
"Be glad I didn't grudge you fire, too."
Craster was a thick man, made thicker by the ragged, smelly sheepskins he wore day and night. He had a broad, flat nose, a mouth that drooped to one side, and a missing ear. And though his matted hair and tangled beard might be grey going white, his hard, knuckly hands still looked strong enough to hurt.
"I fed you what I could, but you crows are always hungry. I'm a godly man, else I would have chased you off. You think I like the likes of him dying on my floor? You think I need all your mouths, little man?"
The wildling spat.
"Crows, when did a blackbird ever bring good to a man's hall, I ask you? Never. Never."
More broth ran from the corner of Bannon's mouth. Sam dabbed it away with the corner of his sleeve. The ranger's eyes were open but unseeing.
"I'm cold," he said again, so faintly.
A maester might have known how to save him, but they had no maester. Kedge Whiteye had taken Bannon's mangled foot off 9 days past, in a gout of pus and blood that made Sam sick. But it was too little, too late.
I'm so cold,
the pale lips repeated. About the hall, a ragged score of black brothers squatted on the floor or sat on rough-hewn benches, drinking cups of the same thin onion broth and gnawing on chunks of hard bread. A couple were wounded worse than Bannon, to look at them.
Fornio had been delirious for days, and Sir Byam's shoulder was oozing a foul yellow pus. When they'd left Castle Black, Brown Bernard had been carrying bags of Moorish fire, mustard salve, ground garlic, tansy, poppy, king's copper, and other healing herbs. Even sweet sleep, which gave the gift of painless death. But Brown Bernard had died on the fist, and no one had thought to search for Maester Aemon's medicines. Hake had known some herb lore as well, being a cook, but Hake was also lost. So it was left to the surviving stewards to do what they could for the wounded, which was little enough.
"At least they are dry here, with a fire to warm them. They need more food, though."
They all needed more food. The men had been grumbling for days. Clubfoot Carl kept saying how Craster had to have a hidden larder, and Garth of Oldtown had begun to echo him when he was out of the Lord Commander's hearing. Sam had thought of begging for something more nourishing for the wounded men at least, but he did not have the courage. Craster's eyes were cold and mean, and whenever the wildling looked his way, his hands twitched a little, as if they wanted to curl up into fists.
"Does he know I spoke to Gilly the last time we were here?"
he wondered.
"Did she tell him I said we'd take her? Did he beat it out of her?"
"I'm cold," said Bannon. "Please, I'm cold.
For all the heat and smoke in Craster's hall, Sam felt cold himself.
"I'm tired, so tired."
He needed sleep, but whenever he closed his eyes, he dreamed of blowing snow and dead men shambling toward him with black hands and bright blue eyes. Up in the loft, Gilly let out a shuddering sob that echoed down the long, low, windowless hall. "Push!" he heard one of Craster's older wives tell her.
"Harder! Harder! Scream if it helps!"
She did, so loud it made Sam wince. Craster turned his head to glare.
"I've had a bellyful of that shrieking," he shouted up. "Give her a rag to bite down on, or I'll come up there and give her a taste of my hand."
He would too, Sam knew. Craster had 19 wives, but none who dared interfere once he started up that ladder. No more than the Black Brothers had 2 nights past, when he was beating one of the younger girls. There had been mutterings, to be sure.
"He's killing her,"
Garth of Greenaway had said, and Clubfoot Carl laughed and said,
"If he don't want the little sweetmeat, he should give it to me."
Black Bernard cursed a low, angry voice, and Alan of Rosby got up and went outside so he wouldn't have to hear. "His roof, his rule," the ranger Ronald Harclay had reminded them. "Craster's a friend to the watch."
"A friend,"
Sam thought, as he listened to Gilly's muffled shrieks. Craster was a brutal man who ruled his wives and daughters with an iron hand, but his keep was a refuge all the same.
"Frozen crows,"
Craster sneered, when they straggled in, those few who had survived the snow, the whites, and the bitter cold.
"Are not so big a flock as went north, neither."
Yet he had given them space on his floor, a roof to keep the snow off, a fire to dry them out, and his wives had brought them cups of hot wine to put some warmth in their bellies.
"Bloody crows,"
he called them, but he fed them too, meager though the fare might be.
"We are his guests," Sam reminded himself. "Gilly is his. His daughter, his wife, his roof, his rule."
The first time he'd seen Craster's keep, Gilly had come begging for help, and Sam had lent her his black cloak to conceal her belly when she went to find Jon Snow.
"Knights are supposed to defend women and children."
Only a few of the Black Brothers were knights, but even so,
"we all say the words," Sam thought. "I am the shield that guards the realms of men."
A woman was a woman, even a wildling woman.
"We should help her, we should."
It was her child Gilly feared for. She was frightened that it might be a boy. Craster raised up his daughters to be his wives, but there were neither men nor boys to be seen about his compound. Gilly had told John that Craster gave his sons to the guards.
"If the guards are good, they will send her a daughter," Sam prayed.
Up in the loft, Gilly choked back a scream.
"That's it," a woman said. "Another push now. Oh, I see his head."
"Hers," Sam thought miserably. "Her head, hers."
"Cold," said Bannon weakly. "Please, I'm so cold."
Sam put the bowl and spoon aside, tossed another fur across the dying man, put another stick on the fire. Gilly gave a shriek and began to pant. Craster gnawed on his hard black sausage. He had sausages for himself and his wives, he said, but none for the watch.
"Women," he complained, "the way they wail. I had me a fat shell once, burst a litter of eight with no more than a grunt."
Chewing, he turned his head to squint contemptuously at Sam.
"She was near as fat as you, boy, slayer."
He laughed. It was more than Sam could stand. He stumbled away from the fire pit, stepping awkwardly over and around the men sleeping and squatting and dying upon the hard-packed earthen floor. The smoke and screams and moans were making him feel faint. Bending his head, he pushed through the hanging deer-hide flaps that served Craster for a door and stepped out into the afternoon. The day was cloudy, but still bright enough to blind him after the gloom of the hall. Some patches of snow weighed down the limbs of surrounding trees and blanketed the gold and russet hills, but fewer than there had been. The storm had passed on, and the days at Craster's Keep had been, well, not warm, perhaps, but not so bitter cold. Sam could hear the soft drip, drip, drip of water melting off the icicles that bearded the edge of the thick sod roof. He took a deep, shuddering breath and looked around. To the west, Olo Laphand and Tim Stone were moving among the horse lines, feeding and watering the remaining garrons. Downwind, other brothers were skinning and butchering the animals deemed too weak to go on. Spearmen and archers walked sentry behind the earthen dikes that were Craster's only defense against whatever hid in the woods beyond, while a dozen fire pits sent up thick fingers of blue-gray smoke. Sam could hear the distant echoes of axes at work in the forest, where a work detail was harvesting enough wood to keep the blazes burning all through the night. Nights were the bad time, when it got dark and cold. There had been no attacks while they had been at Craster's, neither whites nor others. Nor would there be, Craster said.
"A godly man's got no cause to fear such. I said as much to that manx raider once when he come sniffing round. He never listened, no more than you crows with your swords and your bloody fires. That won't help you none when the white cold comes. Only the gods will help you then. You'd best get right with the gods."
Gilly had spoken of the white cold as well, and she'd told them what sort of offerings Craster made to his gods. Sam had wanted to kill him when he heard.
"There are no laws beyond the wall," he reminded himself, "and Craster's a friend to the watch."
A ragged shout went up from behind the daub and wattle hall. Sam went to take a look. The ground beneath his feet was a slush of melting snow and soft mud that Dolorous Ed insisted was made of Craster's shit. It was thicker than shit, though. It sucked at Sam's boots so hard he felt one pull loose. Back of a vegetable garden, an empty sheepfold, a dozen black brothers were loosing arrows at a butt they'd built of hay and straw. The slender blonde steward they called Sweet Donald had laid a shaft just off the bull's-eye at 50 yards.
"Best that, old man," he said.
"Aye, I will."
Alma, stooped and grey-bearded and loose of skin and limb, stepped to the mark and pulled an arrow from the quiver at his waist. In his youth he had been an outlaw, a member of the infamous Kingswood Brotherhood.
he claimed he'd once put an arrow through the hand of the white bull of the King's Guard to steal a kiss from the lips of a Dornish princess. He had stolen her jewels, too, and a chest of golden dragons, but it was the kiss he liked to boast of in his cups. He notched and drew, all smooth as summer silk, then let fly. His shaft struck the butt an inch inside of Donald Hill's.
"Will that do, lad?"
he asked, stepping back. "Well enough," said the younger man grudgingly. "The crosswind helped you. It blew more strongly when I loosed."
"You're tough loud for that, then. You have a good eye and a steady hand, but you'll need a deal more to best a man of the Kingswood. Fletcher Dick it was who showed me how to bend the bow, and no finer archer ever lived. Have I told you about old Dick now?"
"Only 300 times." Every man at Castle Black had heard Ulmer's tales of the great outlaw band of yore, of Simon Toyne and the Smiling Knight, Oswin Longneck the Thrice Hanged, Wender the White Fawn, Fletcher Dick, Big Belly Ben, and all the rest. Searching for escape, Sweet Donal looked about and spied Sam standing in the muck.
"Slayer," he called, "come show us how you slew the other."
He held out the tall yew longbow. Sam turned red.
"It wasn't an arrow, it was a dagger, dragon glass."
He knew what would happen if he took the bow. He would miss the butt and send the arrow sailing over the dike into the trees. Then he'd hear the laughter.
"No matter," said Alan of Rosby, another fine bowman. "We're all keen to see the slayer shoot, aren't we, lads?"
He could not face them. The mocking smiles, the mean little jests, the contempt in their eyes. Sam turned to go back the way he'd come, but his right foot sank deep in the muck, and when he tried to pull it out, his boot came off. He had to kneel to wrench it free, laughter ringing in his ears. Despite all his socks, the snow melt had soaked through to his toes by the time he made his escape.
"Useless," he thought miserably. "My father saw me through. I have no right to be alive when so many brave men are dead."
Gren was tending the fire pit south of the compound gate, stripped to the waist as he split logs. His face was red with exertion, the sweat steaming off his skin. But he grinned as Sam came chuffing up.
"The others get your boots, Slayer." "Him too." "It was the mud. Please don't call me that." "Why not?"
Gren sounded honestly puzzled.
"It's a good name, and you came by it fairly."
Pip always teased Gren about being thick as a castle wall, so Sam explained patiently.
"It's just a different way of calling me a coward," he said, standing on his left leg and wriggling back into his muddy boot. "They're mocking me, the same way they mock Bedwick, by calling him Giant." "He's not a giant, though," said Gren. "And Paul was never small. Well, maybe when he was a baby at the breast, but not after. You did slay the other, though, so it's not the same. I was scared." "No more than me. It's only Pip who says I'm too dumb to be frightened. I get as frightened as anyone."
Gren bent to scoop up a split log and toss it into the fire.
"I used to be scared of John. Whenever I had to fight him, he was so quick, and he fought like he meant to kill me."
The green damp wood sat in the flames, smoking before it took fire.
"I never said, though. Sometimes I think everyone is just pretending to be brave, and none of us really are. Maybe pretending is how you get brave, I don't know. Let them call you Slayer. Who cares?"
"You never liked Sir Alistair calling you Oryx."
"He was saying I was big and stupid."
Gren stretched his beard.
"If Pip wanted to call me Oryx, though, he could. Or you, or John. And Oryx is a fierce, strong beast, so that's not so bad. And I am big, and getting bigger. Wouldn't you rather be Sam the Slayer than Sir Piggy?"
Why can't I just be Samwell Tarly?"
He sat down heavily on a wet log that Gren had yet to split.
"It was the dragonglass that slew it. Not me, the dragonglass."
He had told them. He had told them all. Some of them didn't believe him, he knew. Dirk had shown Sam his dirk and said, "I've got iron. What do I want with glass?" Black Banar and the three Garths made it plain that they doubted his whole story. And Rowley of Sisterton came right out and said,
"More like you stabbed some rustling bushes, and it turned out to be Small Paul taking a shit. So you came up with a lie."
But Dywin listened, and Dollar as Ed, and they made Sam and Gren tell the Lord Commander. Mormont frowned all through the tale and asked pointed questions, but he was too cautious a man to shun any possible advantage. He asked Sam for all the dragonglass in his pack, though that was little enough. Whenever Sam thought of the cash John had found buried beneath a fist, it made him want to cry. There had been dagger blades and spearheads and 200 or 300 arrowheads at least. John had made daggers for himself, Sam, and Lord Commander Mormont, and he'd given Sam a spearhead, an old broken horn, and some arrowheads. Gren had taken a handful of arrowheads as well, but that was all. So now all they had was Mormont's dagger and the one Sam had given Gren, plus 19 arrows and a tall hardwood spear with a black dragonglass head. The sentries passed the spear along from watch to watch, while Mormont had divided the arrows among his best bowmen, Muttering Bill, Garth Greyfeather, Ronald Harclay, Sweet Donald Hill, and Alan of Rosbeer had 3 apiece, and Ulmer had 4. But even if they made every shaft tell, they'd soon be down to fire arrows like all the rest. They had loosed hundreds of fire arrows on the fist, yet still the whites kept coming.
"It will not be enough," Sam thought.
Craster's sloping palisades of mud and melting snow would hardly slow the whites, who climbed the much steeper slopes of the fist to swarm over the ring wall. And instead of 300 brothers drawn up in disciplined ranks to meet them, the whites would find 41 ragged survivors, 9 too badly hurt to fight. 44 had come straggling into Craster's out of the storm, out of the 60-odd who cut their way free of the fist, but 3 of those had died of their wounds, and Bannon would soon make 4.
"Do you think the whites are gone?" Sam asked Gren. "Why don't they come finish us?" "They only come when it's cold." "Yes," said Sam. "But is it the cold that brings the whites, or the whites that bring the cold?" "Who cares?"
Gren's axe sent wood chips flying.
"They come together. That's what matters. Hey, now that we know that dragonglass kills them, maybe they won't come at all. Maybe they're frightened of us now."
Sam wished he could believe that. But it seemed to him that when you were dead, fear had no more meaning than pain or love or duty. He wrapped his hands around his legs, sweating under the layers of wool and leather and fur. The dragonglass dagger had melted the pale thing in the woods, true, but Gren was talking like it would do the same to the whites.
"We don't know that," he thought. "We don't know anything, really. I wish John was here."
He liked Gren, but he couldn't talk to him the same way.
"John wouldn't call me Slayer, I know, and I could talk to him about Gilly's baby."
John had ridden off with Corrin Halfhand, though, and they had no word of him since.
"He had a dragonglass dagger, too. But did he think to use it? Is he lying dead and frozen in some ravine? Or worse, is he dead and walking?"
He could not understand why the guards would want to take Jon Snow and Bannon and leave him, craven and clumsy as he was. He should have died on the fist, where he'd pissed himself 3 times and lost his sword besides. And he would have died in the woods if Small Paul had not come along to carry him.
"I wish it was all a dream. Then I could wake up."
How fine that would be, to wake back on the fist of the first men, with all his brothers still around him, even John and Ghost. Or even better, to wake in Castle Black behind the wall, and go to the common room for a bowl of 3-finger hubs, thick cream of wheat,